Florida is just one day away from the start of the first black bear hunt in the state in 20 years. That's in spite of a flurry of legal challenges and protests. People opposed to the hunt have taken to emailing hunters who've signed up for a permit. They're urging them not to take part. And there's a series of protests around the state, including Melbourne, Ocala and Orlando later this morning. Will you be joining one of those rallies? Are you going hunting? Have the protests made you reconsider? We'll be talking about the bear hunt later in the program and taking your calls at 1-866 338 5252. We'll also discuss a batch of gun bills moving along in the Florida legislature. They include an open carry bill, a bill that would allow concealed carry permit holders to bring their guns onto college campuses. And then there's legislation to strengthen the state's so-called stand your ground law. What effect would open carry have? What does it mean for law enforcement? But first, congressional politics. Central Florida's Dan Webster says he's not quitting the race for Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. That's after Wisconsin's Paul Ryan announced he'll seek the speakership, pending some conditions. And then there's Charlie Crist, the former governor of Florida who ran unsuccessfully for the Senate and mounted an unsuccessful campaign last year to return to the governor's mansion. He's getting back on the campaign trail. Crist announced this week he's running for Congress, the seat currently held by David Jolly on the West Coast. Can he get the votes he needs to win that seat on his home turf of Pinellas County? Will enough Democrats vote for this former Republican, or will the newly drawn district make him a shoo-in? What do you think of Charlie Crist's latest run? Will we see a return of the travelling fan? 1-866-338-5252. Well, joining me in the studio, Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Welcome back, Frank.
Thank you so much.
And we're joined also by Matt Reed, columnist with Florida Today and host of the Matt Reed Show. Matt, thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
And Retta Peoples from the Orlando Sun. Retta, nice to see you again.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Well, Charlie Crist is running for Congress. Can he succeed after two failed election campaigns, one for Senate and again for governor? Do you want to see Charlie Crist back in elected office? If he were elected, would he remain a congressman or maybe seek a higher office? We're at 1-866-338-5252, taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252. Let's listen to a little bit of Charlie Crist's stump speech on Tuesday.
Yeah, well, you know, I've run a fair amount of races, and I've won some and I've lost some. And I think you'd learn more from the losses than you do from the victories. And what I have learned is that you have to listen as hard as you can and go out and talk to people as much as you possibly can. They're the boss. And that's what I'm going to do in this campaign, and I really look forward to it.
Well, the district Charlie Crist is running in is David Jolly's seat right now, but after Crist's announcement, Jolly said Crist was, quote, a huckster and the worst member of Congress he'd served with. Frank Torres, Crist said this bid for Senate is a bid for Congress, rather, is about service and that, quote, public service is in my heart. Is it public service or the lure of the political spotlight you think that's got him running again?
You know, I think deep down in the complicated mind of Charlie Crist, it's a little bit of both. I think there is some sincerity behind his desire to help the community and to serve. But also, this is his, I believe, third race in four election cycles for a different post. And he seems to just be jumping in wherever he can get these political opportunities. You know, he's a very gifted retail politician, very warm, and has a strong message. And he stands a very good shot of winning this seat. I think it was an opportunity that he almost couldn't afford to ignore if he has political dreams to continue climbing that ladder.
Do you see him climbing that ladder? Do you think he'll stick around in Congress for a while if he gets in?
You know, if he gets in, he's going to be around for a while, and he will try to climb that ladder. It's tougher to do it from Congress, but he's going to continue to try to find a way, especially if Hillary Clinton is the next president, to try to climb up in that administration. Mm-hmm. His dream is the White House. He wants to be either the president or the vice president, and he's going to do whatever he has to do to get there, no matter how many races he has to run and how many positions he has to take. So, you know, he's a unique creature to Florida politics. He's a lot of fun to watch, and I'm sure this campaign will be a lot of fun to watch as well.
Were you surprised? I mean, he said at the start of the year, I'm not running for anything. I'm going to be supporting other candidates in the Democratic Party. So were you surprised when he said, okay, I'll run, whatever?
Not really. You know, Charlie and the positions, they kind of come and they go. He says sort of goes with the feeling, and he's been called on it several times by opponents and the Republican Party. He's even switched parties three times in the last 5 years, I believe. So, it doesn't come as an extreme surprise, but the personality and the circumstances and the drama involved with the Charlie Crist campaign is why we keep coming back to him every time to cover whatever he does.
And speaking of something else we saw a lot of on the last campaign he was involved with, and we actually saw this, he came to our office, we interviewed him during his gubernatorial bid, and he sent an advance party with a collection of fans with him. How much of that fan are we going to see on this campaign, do you think?
I think we're going to see a lot of that fan. Wherever Charlie Crist goes, so goes the fan. You'll recall that tense debate where Governor Rick Scott refused to take the stage because Charlie Crist had the fan underneath his podium. I believe it was called Fangate. And, you know, it's part of the story behind Charlie Crist, and wherever Charlie Crist goes, the fan will go. And, you know, he should just make it his logo by now.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt Reid, but thinking back to that gubernatorial race, Florida Today endorsed Rick Scott, not Charlie Crist, during that election. And you wrote in a column that Scott's campaign offered more to vote for because it was a positive campaign. Now, the governor's race, of course, a lot different from a congressional campaign. But do you expect to see Charlie Crist go negative in his run for this congressional seat?
Sure. But I mean, Charlie Crist kind of will never be known for that. Charlie Crist's brand is as sort of the smiling wiki governor. You know, he was somebody who, in an age when people are so polarized, you're either 100% Republican or you're 100% Democrat, Charlie Crist was the person who will just do whatever people want him to do because he wants the love and the adoration for doing it, right? He does genuinely love that public service, but it comes with that sort of battery charge, right, of the love. And so I think that's probably how, like you said, at a congressional level, that retail campaigning really can make a much, much bigger impact than running for governor, where it's much more of a media campaign. I think it's going to be he'll probably win. I think he's in an area where that district is fairly purple, and I wish him the very best. It is weird in Florida where you have this famous I-4 corridor with its swing voters, and it is a very purple state in many ways, that the actual political outcomes tend to be so polarized and Republican or Democrat, and depending on where you go. And here's this one guy who just kind of matches that political reality in a lot of ways, and he's just become a character that I think on the right among Republicans, it's almost like become a one-upmanship for how badly can you trash Charlie Crist, and they're good talkers.
It's a sport.
So, yeah, it's pretty fun.
Reader Peoples, let me ask you this. Quoting from Politico here, an article they had Matthew Isbell quoted as saying about Pinellas County, quote, "the white suburban voters who already vote pretty solidly Democratic like Crist just fine, and in the black community a sure Democratic block, and Crist has it wrapped up." But Reader, let me ask you this. What about that comment about the black community? Did Florida's black voters, for example, vote for Charlie Crist in big numbers during the last gubernatorial election?
Well, no, I don't think they did. And one thing that hurt Charlie was the fact that he switched parties three times. Like Frank said, he switched so many times, but he does have that charisma. He has a lot of charisma. He's going to be able to pull a little bit of the black vote. But one thing that's very important is that Florida's black vote, if they don't like anybody that's running, we stay home, you know, and that's very unfortunate. So I hope that doesn't happen in this election, but it is something that we definitely need to watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to Frank. I just want to ask you about Daniel Webster's prospects. Things have changed pretty significantly in the last few days. Paul Ryan saying he's basically running for that seat as long as there are some conditions met, trying to kind of lock in the support of the Freedom Caucus there. So what are you hearing? What could Dan Webster do from here to try and swing things in his favor for the House speakership?
You know, it's Paul Ryan's job if he wants it. And there's some irony here because when Daniel Webster first got to Washington, the one person he admired the most, the one person he wanted to see on that presidential ticket was Paul Ryan. Now he's going to have to compete against the one person he admired when he got to Washington. Daniel Webster's going to have his block of support. Is it going to be enough to catch up to the establishment vote that Paul Ryan inherited from John Boehner? You'll recall Paul Ryan was one of John Boehner's first choices to take this job. Mm-hmm. And Ryan would not jump in this race unless he's absolutely sure he can win it. So it's going to be a tough uphill climb for Daniel Webster. But, you know, he's a warrior. He's going to keep he's going to still stay out there making those phone calls to the other members and trying to punch this thing out to see if he can sort of move the needle in his direction to try to make something happen. But it's a tough challenge. I think Paul Ryan's a tougher challenge than Kevin McCarthy would have been. And some of the other candidates have even dropped out. So we'll see what he can do. I mean, if there's anybody I believe that's possible that has the potential to pull off in a massive upset like that is Daniel Webster. But it's going to be a tough challenge for him.
He's still staying on message, though, right. Talking about pushing down the pyramid there, trying to make things more equitable for the other members of Congress.
Right, and I think that's a very worthy message. That's a very positive message, and it wouldn't hurt for Washington to take his advice. The speaker has an unusually powerful amount of power. You'll recall there was retaliation from John Boehner when Daniel Webster ran against him last time, kicked him off the Ways and Means Committee along with some of the people that voted for him. Daniel Webster might not win the speakership, but his message certainly deserves a strong look at in Washington.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about a little bit of state politics now. The Confederate battle flag has been taken off the seal of the Florida Senate. Now, it's not the only flag on that seal. There's one for each of the five flags that were flown over Florida. Did you know that there was a Confederate battle flag on that seal? Is it fair to remove it? And what about the history of the state? Is replacing that flag with the Florida flag appropriate? Give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Rita Peoples, let me ask you about that seal. What was your kind of comprehension of it? Did you realize there was that Confederate battle flag on the seal before this came up in the Florida legislature?
Yes, actually, I was aware of it. I went to school in Tallahassee and grew up in Tampa, so I'm aware of the big flag that flies over native land in Tampa, and then also the flag that used to fly over the Capitol in Tallahassee. And I do think it should be removed. I do. I think that if it is, it wasn't a legitimate government, and I think it should definitely be taken down if it doesn't represent the vast majority of Floridians. If it doesn't represent us all, we don't feel proud when we see it, it needs to be removed.
Is there an argument to be made, though, that issues like this can kind of take away attention from other things that the legislature should be dealing with, other more kind of nuts and bolts issues that, you know, laws to be made, that sort of thing?
Yes and no. I definitely think that lawmakers in Florida have more than enough on their hands, especially with the redrawing of the congressional lines. But I do think this is something that is very near and dear to the hearts of a lot of Floridians. Mm-hmm. So I think it's worth the time of our lawmakers.
Matt Reed, there's always a bit of backlash from supporters of the Confederate flag, whether it's the battle flag or other versions of it. And we've seen that, for example, with NASCAR, when NASCAR put out that directive to please keep your flags home or don't fly them, we'll give you another flag instead. For those who say it's a symbol of Southern pride, do you get the sense that that backlash might die down a bit eventually?
Well, I think in this case, with the Senate seal, I mean, Senator Andy Gardner, the Senate president, I think he just kind of made a unilateral move to just do it and didn't take a vote to put people on the record. And so that's kind of a done deal. But you hear, we hear it in Melbourne, for example, when, you know, the city council considers whether it's going to continue to sponsor a parade in which this flag flies. Listen, I think for policymakers, you don't get a chance to decide sometimes when you lead. And I think that, like Retta said, you got to think about all your constituents. And it's obvious that for some people, it's a symbol of Southern pride. For other people, it's never not going to be a symbol of racism and the reason why these states succeeded, which was to preserve slavery, period. And so I think if you're looking on behalf of all the people that you serve, you go with the remove the flag.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, real quickly, some lawmakers have filed bills for next year that prohibit any Confederate flags or symbols being used by local county or state government. Do you see a fight brewing over this in 2016?
You know, I don't see a fight of brewing in 2016. I believe Geraldine Thompson, Orlando State Senator, is sponsoring that bill.
Yep.
The one issue about getting this thing passed will be time. Everybody's got their priorities in Tallahassee. They're going to have a compacted legislative session with the election season hovering above them. The only question is, will they have enough time to get this thing done and get it passed? And if it'll just get in front of the legislators for them to make a decision on it. Other than that, I think they'll look other places and see what they've done, and it should gain traction. The main word is going to be time.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we return, the state's first bear hunt in 20 years gets underway this weekend. 3,134 permits, that's how many have been sold, and there are just over 3,500 bears estimated in the whole state. Only 320 can be killed during the hunt. What's the effect going to be on the population of bears? Will it help reduce maulings? Are you going hunting? Have the protests and publicity over the hunt changed your mind? Or will you be one of the protesters monitoring the hunt? We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, honoring firefighters throughout Central Florida who risk their lives every day to save the lives of those who otherwise would have perished. Florida Hospital, thanking firefighters who do not just stamp out flames, they change lives. Florida Hospital, life is amazing.
Good morning. Nice to have you along. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking your calls. Join the conversation. You can take us anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Valencia College Continuing Education. Valencia's collaborative design center was created to help businesses and organizations design solutions for cultural change, critical problems, and future development. ValenciaCollege.edu/continuing ed.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer, Rheta Peoples with the Orlando Sun, and Matt Reed, Florida Today. Florida's bear hunt gets underway tomorrow. Black bears were removed from the threatened list in 2012, and this will be the first bear hunt in Florida in 20 years. More than 3,100 hunters have bought permits to hunt a bear, but there's also been loud protest about the hunt from environmentalists. Are you planning to join the bear hunt this weekend? If you shoot a bear, what will you do with it? 1-866-338-5252. We're joined also in the studio by 90.7's Amy Green. She's been following the story. Amy, welcome to Intersection.
Thanks for having me.
Amy's been combing over documents from the state showing hundreds of bears have been euthanized over the years. So the goal is 320 bears. Why that number, and how many bears are likely to be killed during this hunt in this first weekend?
That's right, Matt. 320 bears. That number is based on population estimates and mortality rates. Those are population estimates, including estimates dating to 2002. Now, this has been kind of a controversial aspect of the hunt. Environmentalists have been criticizing the state agency, Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, for not waiting until a population count is complete before having this hunt.
Right. So those numbers go back more than a decade now.
That's right. Some of them do. And so Florida Fish and Wildlife says because the population is thought to have grown in 13 years, Florida Fish and Wildlife believes the target of 320 bears is a conservative one. Mm-hmm. As for how many bears are likely to be killed, well, that's hard to say. Florida Fish and Wildlife says hunt rules likely will make that target difficult to reach. Hunters will be limited by rules like they won't be able to bait bears and things like that. But environmentalists say that the target almost certainly will be reached, and it's possible it could be reached within the first day of the hunt. So they filed a lawsuit to try to stop the hunt, but they were unsuccessful.
Okay, so just a couple of basics on this. Who can hunt and where can they hunt?
Well, hunters with permits can hunt in four areas in the East Panhandle and North Central and South Florida. Now, in Central Florida, the hunting area surrounds Ocala National Forest and includes a dozen wildlife management areas. The goal here is 100 bears. Mm-hmm. Permits cost $100 for Florida residents and $300 for non-residents. Today is the last day they're available for sale.
We're talking about the upcoming bear hunt. It starts tomorrow. If you are going to join the hunt, or maybe you're thinking you're going to join a protest today, later this morning, there's some protests around the state. We'd like to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252. Amy Green, what about bears being a problem in the suburbs? What does Florida Fish and Wildlife do when those bears wander into the suburbs and start interfering with people and garbage and the like?
That's right. That's been a really big problem here in Central Florida. We have the state's largest bear population, and three women were mauled in Central Florida. A fourth person was mauled in the Panhandle. Maulings took place in 2013 and 2014. So it's a really big problem in Central Florida. Florida Fish and Wildlife says the best way to keep bears out of neighborhoods is to eliminate food sources like trash. But when bears do become a problem, Florida Fish and Wildlife says that they are now taking a more aggressive approach to this problem, and that includes more euthanizations. They say that, you know, many residents want asked for the bears to be relocated.
Right.
But Florida Fish and Wildlife says that's really not as effective because when bears are accustomed or habituated to getting food from neighborhoods, they'll just continue the behavior either in their new location or they'll return to the neighborhood that they know, and they'll just continue to do that. So since 2007, Florida Fish and Wildlife has euthanized nearly 400 bears, mm-hmm. and obviously that's more than the 320 targeted by the hunt.
Okay, so and they're saying that they basically don't have a choice but to euthanize the bears. Is that what Florida Fish and Wildlife is telling you?
Right. Like I said, you know, residents usually will ask for the bears to be relocated, but you know, Florida Fish and Wildlife, the bear experts say what we have in Florida now is a situation where bears are basically living in suburban areas. They are accustomed to getting their food from there. They're comfortable there, and they'll just continue that behavior. Bears can smell food from a mile away, mm-hmm. and they will travel long distances for it. And so they'll just continue the behavior either they'll go back to the neighborhood or they'll just keep doing it in their current location.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'll use donuts and the like to bait those traps. So you got a donut out there, a bear 100 miles away is probably licking its lips. Well, let's go to the phones now. We've got Suzanne. Suzanne, you're on the air calling from Orlando. What are your thoughts on this impending hunt?
Just a question. Mm-hmm. If the hunt is going to occur in the forest areas and the problem is in the residential areas, how is that going to help the bear attacks for residents?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't understand the whole process.
Suzanne, that's a great question. Thanks for your question. Amy Green, what's Florida Fish and Wildlife saying about that? I mean, is this hunt basically out in the wilderness in Florida, such as it is that going to have a measurable impact on what's going on in these suburban neighborhoods?
That's right. The caller makes a great point. Florida Fish and Wildlife says bears in neighborhoods is not the reason for the hunt. The reason for the hunt is to manage the bear population. Florida Fish and Wildlife says the bear population has grown so much that it's on the verge of outgrowing its habitat, mm-hmm. and there wouldn't be enough open space and food for the bears. So it's really unlikely to have a big impact on this problem of bears in neighborhoods. The solution there, Florida Fish and Wildlife says, is eliminating food sources.
Right. Suzanne, can I ask you, do you live in an area where you get bears wandering down your street, rummaging through the trash, that kind of thing?
I live in Sorrento, mm-hmm. so we do have bears periodically around here, and I work close to the Wekiva Springs area.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of my patients have had encounters with bears,
mm-hmm.
but they're, you know, even if they have the encounter with the bear, you know, they just simply would prefer that they have people, you know, closing their trash containers,
right.
and trying to prevent the attacks in that way.
Are people pretty savvy? Do you get the sense that people in the Sorrento area are pretty knowledgeable about, you know, what not to do as far as leaving your trash unsecured, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think everybody tries to, you know, put their trash out, you know, early in the morning, not overnight,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So I think it's pretty okay here in this area.
Suzanne, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate you listening and calling in.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay, so let's go to Matt Reed. We've heard plenty about the bear hunt in Seminole, Volusia, and Orange County. What about Brevard County? You know, do you get nuisance bears wandering into people's garbage or, you know, interfering with dogs, mauling people? We don't hear so much about that in Brevard County, but is it happening?
Not often, no. I mean, we really only have some parts kind of in the north and northwestern parts of Brevard County, around Mims, Scottsmore, where you might have some bears out there, but it's mm-hmm. the numbers are not high. There certainly are plenty of hunters who might be getting these permits and traveling to some place to try to get the bears. But no, I just think we might be at the southern end of their range in Florida. We have more things like you might see elsewhere in Central Florida, like pigs and turkeys, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things that people hunt.
Alligators.
Plenty of alligators. In fact, I'm going to be out planting cypress trees in a place that has a few gators this Saturday for Make It a Difference Day.
Mm-hmm. 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts on this upcoming bear hunt? Maybe you're thinking you're going to take part, you've got a permit in your pocket, or maybe you've had second thoughts about it, or maybe you're one of those folks who's going to be joining one of the protest rallies later this morning. 1-866-338-5252. Talking about the protests, Reda People's doesn't seem that they've had much impact on stopping the hunt so far. So what else can we expect in the way of popular protest against the hunt?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of social media. We're going to see some ground protests and even a silent protest. Mm-hmm. I've heard that some people are thinking about buying the permits that are in support of the bears, buying up the permits and doing nothing with them. So I think that that's a great way for them to, if it's legal, a great way for them to make their voices heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, presumably you can buy it. Nobody's going to tell you you have to hunt a bear if you buy a permit.
Exactly. So I think that's a good way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, what about readers of Florida Today? I mean, what's been the response from folks writing into your newspaper?
Oh, listen. We've gotten a lot of letters against the hunt. I mean, there are people who care about these bears and these animals. You're going to find them everywhere, and the passions are running pretty high about this. We get a lot of concern about the numbers. I think what Amy just mentioned was the number of permits versus the number of bears, and is this population settled or not? It is a little bit scary to think that you have 3,000 plus permits with 300 bears that they're looking to take, and the permits almost match the population. I mean, how do you? For me, as somebody kind of in the middle of moderating that debate on our pages, my big question is how do you limit the number of bears that are bagged in the end with that many hunters allowed to take them?
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, just talking about who's buying these permits. Amy Green mentioned that it's $100 for a Florida resident, $300 if you're not from Florida. And we do know of at least one non-Florida resident. We've got outspoken rocker Ted Nugent. He's planning to take part in the hunt. But also down here in Florida, Representative Frank Tillis from Miami has bought a permit. Is this kind of a dangerous move for a politician to be saying, yep, I'm buying one of these permits?
Not if you're a conservative like those two. I think it's red meat, for political red meat for your base, and it shows that you're for the Second Amendment and for individual rights to do things like these. So for them, there's really little political risk involved. A lot of their base, a lot of their supporters are casual hunters, deer hunters, gator hunters, and all the other kinds of authorized wildlife that you can have. Mm-hmm. So while there is a very passionate group against the bears, I've written several times about them. There's a group that's going to be out there with the hunters, making sure that they follow the rules to a T, or else they're going to report them. So while there is a very passionate group against these hunts, there's also the normal group of wildlife hunters that are ready to go and ready to participate in the sport.
And I wonder, we haven't heard so much from them.
Nope. Obviously the controversies involved, there's still, even among the most hardcore hunters, there's a respect for the wildlife itself. You do see the occasional unwise person who decides to make a spectacle on social media. But for the most part, hunters are fairly respectful of the rules and try to adhere to them as much as possible, or else they'll get fined or even thrown in jail. Mm-hmm. So I believe there's a strong side for it as well. But maybe not as outspoken as the ones who are passionate for who are trying to save the bears and try to move this hunt along.
1-866-338-5252. If you're a hunter, if you're planning to take part, wondering what you're thinking about the protests, the controversy around this hunt. Is it too much, do you think? Give us a call. 1-866-338-5252. Going to the phones, we've got Robert. Robert's calling from Brevard. What's on your mind, Robert?
Good morning. I agree with your first caller, Suzanne, that they should be targeting the problem bears, not so much the bears in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's a failed policy.
Do you see bears out in your neck of the woods, Robert?
No. We got most of your other critters in Florida. I live in near Titusville. We've got bobcats, which are quite large, but haven't been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Deer, king pigs, turkeys, et cetera, et cetera. But we haven't had the bears.
Mm-hmm. So
I don't think it would be a real issue here, because we don't seem to have a bear population around here. Like they were saying, maybe a few up around Mims, not more, but I guess they're more in the central part of the state. But, if they're a problem in the neighborhood, then you got the problem of firearms in the neighborhood. You know, that's that's an issue. I'm not sure how they would solve that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the neighborhood bears, that's something that Fish and Wildlife really has to, they have to deal with those and relocate or euthanize
yeah, and
them.
Yeah, I don't think they're doing a very good job.
Mm-hmm. Robert, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate you calling in. So just thinking about what happens in those neighborhoods, and Amy Green, you talked to a resident or two explaining how these trash-proof, these bear-proof trash cans, rather, work. You had that story earlier in the week about how Florida Fish and Wildlife is trying to enforce those regulations prohibiting food and trash and where it's left out. And you spoke to a resident in Lake Mary, Janice Springfield. She showed you how to operate this can. Let's just listen to a little bit of that.
See if you can open the bear can. See what it says.
Okay, so there are instructions here. It says, step one, using one hand, insert finger into lock mechanism opening. Okay. Pull trigger inside lock mechanism back using inserted finger. Using the other hand, grip top piece of lock. So I'm, okay.
There, that one came
out. Okay, so we did it together because I'm holding my microphone. Yep. Okay.
The sound of a pretty solid trash can lid closing there. These things sound quite impregnable.
That's right. So Janice Springfield, she lives in Lake Mary, and she and her husband, they estimate they've had about a dozen bears on their property. One bear charged her. Mm-hmm. And so the couple invested in a bear-resistant trash can. They got an electric fence and some other things. And so the bear-resistant trash can, she says they are a little more expensive, and their trash provider charges them an additional fee because the trash cans, the trucks can't lift them up and dump them, you know.
Right. What are they made of?
I don't know what they're made of, but she says the bears cannot get into them.
Mm-hmm.
They are a little heavier, too. And so the couple, they're in their 80s, and so they've had some difficulty handling them. They've had some difficulty with that lock mechanism. But Florida Fish and Wildlife says that part of the proceeds from the hunt they want to put toward making these bear-resistant trash cans more available. Seminole County considered a measure that would require the trash cans in certain neighborhoods, but the measure failed. The Florida Fish and Wildlife says, you know, like I said, the key to this thing is eliminating food sources, and a big problem in a lot of these neighborhoods is the morning of trash day. You know, there's a bear smorgasbord lined up on these streets. And so that's why there's all this talk about these bear-resistant trash cans.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, a little tricky to open these cans if you're in your 80s. Maybe you don't have the finger strength.
Right.
Do you see them catching on? I mean, are people going to be just voluntarily getting the trash cans even if they don't have to by law?
Well, my impression is that, you know, cost has been, you know, a deterrent for some people. But I think we will continue to hear about this issue going forward because I think this is an issue that will continue.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to Lake Mary now. We've got Mary calling from Lake Mary. We were just talking about, you know, what's going on with those trash, the bear-resistant trash cans there. Mary, what are your thoughts about the bears and the hunt?
Yes, I am not for the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
We've been here for 30 years. We're not bothered by the bears. We take care of our trash. We rinse out our recycling. We don't have any problem with them. I had 2 points. One was that recently Speak Up Wakaiba was able to get an injunction against the FWC to stop it selling saw palmetto berries out of the state forests, mm-hmm. which turns out to be one of the food sources for the bears, and they've been letting people harvest. They've been selling harvesting permits,
mm-hmm.
and they're not allowed to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to stop the hunt for at least 12 to 24 months,
mm-hmm.
if not permanently, to see do the bears stop roaming out of the forest now that their food source is not being taken away.
Right.
And secondly, developers in Florida are not required to do any trapping and humane relocation of large animals
mm-hmm.
when they develop previous wildlife conservation area.
Are you saying that should be a responsibility of developers to take care of that?
Well, they are required to do a survey, mm-hmm. but they are not required to do anything about moving the larger animals, which according to the Hunting and Gaming Commission head, Diane Eggman, can self-relocate.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when they wipe out, say, 120 acres, like they've done here in the last 24 months, and turn it into houses, they knowingly let large animals just roam out of that area, hoping that they will go to a safe area. Mm-hmm. And I think that that law should be changed.
Mm-hmm. Mary, thank you so much for your call. So basically we're talking about land and food kind of resources here. Going to go to Chris now. Chris is calling from Daytona Beach. Your Daytona Beach Shores. Sorry, Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good, thank you.
All right, long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm actually for the bear hunt, although mm-hmm. I don't plan on hunting them myself. I did just move here from New Jersey, who kind of restarted their bear hunt a few years ago, made uh-huh. some national news doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I feel that any state that has a sizable bear population uses a hunt to manage that population, so you have a revenue producer as opposed to something that costs our state money. So I'm for the hunt, and I do think it's possible to shut it down early. I watched in New Jersey as soon as they mm-hmm. Had the right amount of bears come into their stations. In today's world with technology, emails, texts, everything goes out to the hunters
mm-hmm.
and shuts it down pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. So your impression, Chris, is the hunt has been a success since they restarted it in New Jersey?
Well, you know, I'm sure you'll hear both sides or two answers to that story. I think it was a success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was truly a management hunt up there. And I know the first year they did it, they shut the hunt down early. I believe the second year they did as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a reduced amount of bear encounters, which I think was the ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
And going to take one more call here. We've got Ricky calling from Orlando. Ricky, what are your thoughts about this upcoming hunt?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm not a hunter. I wouldn't kill a fly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand the importance of controlling the bear population. My question is, those people that are against the hunting, what is the solution they are proposing for this?
Mm-hmm. Ricky, thanks so much for your call. Amy Green, is there an alternative solution to this hunt? We've talked about relocation. We've talked about people kind of trying to secure their trash. Are there other things on the table that haven't been discussed before?
Yeah, I think the key thing that Florida Fish and Wildlife is proposing is watching the food sources, the bear-resistant trash cans, eliminating those things that draw bears to neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Amy Green covers environmental issues for 90.7 News. We've been talking about the upcoming bear hunt this weekend. Amy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to Intersection on 90.7. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, we're going to take a check into open carry in public places and guns on college campuses. What impact could that have on college life? And what about allowing gun owners to display their weapons in public? Would that help or hinder law enforcement? And would you think twice about setting foot in a park or plaza if there were open carry laws? 1-866-338-5252 is the number when Intersection returns.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Orlando Sentinel, announcing two upcoming sections, Aging Well and Medicare, that are now available online and in the paper this Sunday. These special sections will offer tips on picking a doctor, eating well, exercising, and information about this year's Medicare plans and provider options. OrlandoSentinel.com/subscribe.
Good morning. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking your calls live. Join the conversation. You can also weigh in on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Wineries, with 22 farm wineries throughout the state. Tasting, tours, and day trips showcase the history of winemaking. Many local supermarkets feature Florida wines. More information at tryfloridawine.com.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Welcome back. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer, Matt Reed, Florida Today, and Ressa Peoples, the Orlando Sun. Now, a bunch of gun rights bills are moving through the Florida legislature, among them bills to allow open carry in public places and give concealed weapons permit holders the right to bring their guns onto college campuses. College students, would that make you feel safer? Is it better for law enforcement to be able to see who's carrying a gun in public? 1-866-338-5252. And there's also a bill that would put the onus back on the prosecution in Stand Your Ground cases to prove the accused did not feel threatened. Is Stand Your Ground a law that shouldn't be tinkered with, or does it need another look? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Let's start with that Stand Your Ground law. Reddit Peoples, when they were talking about this, Lucy McBath, whose son Jordan Davis was shot and killed after an altercation at a gas station in Jacksonville, urged lawmakers not to vote for the Stand Your Ground bill. the amendment to it, rather. She said it, quote, adds an additional burden on the state to prove the innocence of the victims and the guilt of the shooters. Does that self-defense law need another look?
I think it does. I think it absolutely needs another look. I had the opportunity to meet Lucy right after her son was murdered, and I feel like she is so very together, and she is, you know, really pushing this thing with lawmakers. And I think they have to look at the Stand Your Ground law, what happened in Sanford with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. Just really divided the community. Mm-hmm. And I think that we really have to look at what's best for our community overall.
Mm-hmm. It's important to note, though, that in the Sanford case, Stand Your Ground did actually not, it wasn't a factor in the trial, but you do make a point about the...
Yes, it wasn't a factor in the trial, but as we look at what's happening with Jordan Davis, it certainly was, absolutely, with Jordan Davis. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it does need to be repealed. And even with Corey Jones in Palm Beach County, what we've seen, I don't know what's going to happen with that, if that's going to be a Stand Your Ground with the officer that was in plain clothes in an unmarked car who walked mm-hmm. up on Corey Jones. And
this is the gentleman who'd stopped, his car had broken down. He was waiting for a tow. And then,
yes, yeah. Absolutely. So we don't know if that's going to come into play as well. Mm-hmm. But because of these cases coming up over and over again, I think that we have to look at this law. We have to see if it needs to be repealed and how often it's going to be used.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about open concealed carry versus open carry? And Frank Torres, I want to go to you on this one. There's been a mixed response to the open carry bill from law enforcement. The Bradford County Sheriff said he'd rather know who has a weapon with him and he'd be able to see it. But the Miami Fraternal Order of Police is quoted as saying it's not a good idea. Javier Ortiz says, quote, unfortunately, people want to be police officers like George Zimmerman. We don't need George Zimmerman to walk around with firearms exposed. End quote. Where do you see this bill going once the next session rolls around?
You know, it's already moving through committee rather quickly. I think there's going to be a certain amount of it's already got traction. I think it's going to get heard, and there's going to be a very lively debate about it. I believe this is just the beginning of the conversation involving open carry and the direction it's heading in Tallahassee. I think the early motion from the legislature indicates that they would support it, and it certainly has a chance of passage.
Mm-hmm. Going to go to the phones now. We've got Rich calling in from New Smyrna Beach. Rich, what are your thoughts on open carry?
Hi, Matthew. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I am totally against open carry, especially on college campuses. Something like that is just, I mean, it's asinine. I mean, really. You have if the people supporting that think they're going to be, like you had just mentioned earlier, somebody's comment about George Zimmerman. You know, they want to be George Zimmerman. Ah, yeah, we're gonna stop this bad guy. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if I had a gun and I were in a situation like that, I wouldn't be pulling it to stop the bad guy because I would be very afraid the law enforcement would take me down instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's make sure we're not kind of confusing these two things, though. You talked about open carry, and then there's the college campus bill. Those are separate bills. But to your point, what about the point from, you know, a law enforcement officer saying, look, as a officer of the law, he'd rather know who has a gun rather than the concealed carry. You know, any of those people could be armed if he's dealing with a crowd.
I mean, that's certainly, you know, their prerogative. I mean, you know, I'm not in law enforcement, but mm-hmm. you know, as a citizen, I don't even like seeing gun racks in the back of trucks. It's like, okay, that bothers me. Mm-hmm. So somebody walking around with a gun in a holster just is something I totally disagree with.
Mm-hmm. Rich, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
And we're going to go to Viviana from Orlando. Viviana, what's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Welcome.
Thank you. When you guys were talking about carry or open carry in college campuses, I'm a college student, and honestly, mm-hmm. I feel very, very uncomfortable seeing people with their guns out pretty much. You know, I don't necessarily don't want to know that whether you have it or not. I'd just be really afraid. Mm-hmm. Of somebody pulling it out, not only, you know, because there's an attacker on campus or whatever, but also if there's a disagreement or mm-hmm. I don't really trust people to be able to know, to have like
Oh my goodness, I forgot to speak English. But anyway, my point is that I'd honestly feel very unsafe if people were to be allowed to bring guns on campus mm-hmm. and have open carry licenses.
Viviana, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Sure. Bye.
Okay, so Matt Reed, I want to ask you about a situation in Vieira. So in Vieira, concealed weapons permit holders can now take their guns inside government buildings. That's per state law. What's been the response to this particular story out in Vieira?
About the same as we just heard on the radio with the callers. I mean, there are people who that I know who are concealed carry permit holders, and they are puzzled about why some places try to pass policies that don't allow them to carry their weapons with them there. I mean, why do I have to keep taking it off and putting it on, leave it in the car here, not there. In Vieira, what they discovered was that state statutes allow county commissions and else other types of bodies to prevent guns from being in their meetings. Mm-hmm. But the state statute does not ban guns from government buildings. Mm-hmm. And local governments in Florida cannot pass policies that are more restrictive than state law. Mm-hmm. Brevard County went through this about 5 or 6 years ago when some permitted gun owners wanted to carry their firearms into a park.
Right.
And they had to rewrite their policy in Brevard County to allow guns in parks because the parks are not on the list of places that are gun-free in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one more call here. We've got Emily calling from Orlando. Emily, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. So I'm a UCF student. This is my fifth year. I just entered grad school at UCF.
I'm afraid we've lost that call. Anyway, we're going to move on from guns to goals, talk about soccer for the moment now. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Orlando City Soccer. We've had a women's league, a professional league. We've heard that the professional women's soccer league is coming to the City Beautiful. That's going to be called the Orlando Pride. They are finalizing a deal to bring that U.S. national women's team star, Alex Morgan, and begin playing next year. Let's hear a little bit from the Orlando City Soccer CEO, Phil Rawlins, talking about Portland.
Portland drew an average of over 15,000 a game last year. So there's no reason why this community can't be drawing 15,000 plus a game for the 10 home games during the regular season.
Well, that's Portland, where obviously a soccer-mad city, but I'm wondering about Orlando. Is Orlando at that point, that critical mass point now, where we can say that Orlando's soccer-mad and that there's going to be good support for those games. Frank Torres, do you think the support from the men's soccer team will transfer over to this new women's team?
You know, I do. And as one of the biggest critics of building a soccer stadium for the city, and the city ultimately ended up stepping up and paying for it itself, the city is a very good project. It delivers a very good product. It's a family-friendly event that brings everybody out, and everybody seems to have a great time. So I think if they can roll that momentum into another franchise, especially when soccer seems to be peaking in the United States, that it's a terrific move. I think the progress they've made here over the last couple of years in such a short amount of time is really extraordinary, and certainly it's certainly an exciting announcement for the community.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, you've written columns about the need for more soccer programs in Brevard, including the demand for a program and Eastern Florida State. There's two professional teams now in the area. Do you think more collegiate teams will come to Central Florida?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, we're at Eastern Florida State College, where we just got the Orlando City minor league team. That program is rapidly becoming an elite, state college program. And we're excited about potentially seeing them form a rivalry with Florida Tech, which also has a longtime strong soccer program. It's kind of funny. Here's this exurban place and otherwise in many ways kind of conservative. But soccer is – I mean, the kids are crazy. Not only are the kids crazy about it, but now you've got an entire generation of parents who grew up playing soccer. Mm-hmm. They don't think twice about soccer being a great professional sports event to go to, just as they would go see baseball.
Right.
So it's been interesting because as we are now seeing professional baseball and minor league baseball spring training kind of fade from Brevard County, mm-hmm. we're starting to see soccer rise up. And I wonder if that's just a generational change or it's just a fluke. Mm-hmm. But it is exciting. And both the Orlando City Lions organization and the college expect there to be pretty strong attendance at these events in Melbourne.
Is that the key that's been missing here for so long, though, the fact that there hasn't been in the past a professional kind of or not so much of a professional sort of sphere to move into once people get out of playing soccer in school?
I think one thing that it seems that Orlando City and maybe other places in America, they're doing it right, is they're kind of following this model that you see in Europe where you have this club that reaches down all the way into the amateur levels. I mean, they're not there yet, but they're having a women's professional team, a minor league team. You've got this feeder system that develops grassroots love, and it's, you know, the players move up and down quite a bit, you know, as you have, you know, top players get called to their national team, so they need somebody from that minor league. So now you're cheering for that guy that you just watched at the local college now playing, you know, on the on TV. And I'm dying to see if it works because we don't necessarily do that in the – we do it a little bit with baseball, but it just isn't quite the same.
Just in the last 15 seconds or so here, Rita Peoples, do you see this women's team in Orlando, is that going to, you know, boost girls getting into soccer here in Orlando?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be great. I think we're going to see kids grow up, especially young girls grow up playing soccer and then have an opportunity to play it professionally. And I think that's going to be really good for Orlando and for women.
Rita Peoples writes for the Orlando Sun. Thanks for coming in, Rita.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Matt Reed, columnist with Florida Today and host of the Matt Reed Show. Thank you so much, Matt.
Always a pleasure.
And Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thank you so much, Frank.
Anytime.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne, executive producer Catherine Welch, production assistants for this week's show from Nicole Christen, Amy Green, and Abe Abariah. Join us next Tuesday morning at 9. We're talking about the harvest season, including farm-to-table dining and urban gardening. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.